and welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate the overlooked, ignored, derided, or the just plain hated. Movies, novels, music, comic books, video games, whatever. If everyone hates it, or even just doesn't know it exists, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is the writer and critic, Amal El-Mokhtar. Amal, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Now, please tell us what you have come on the show to talk about. This will be something that most people who listen to the network will be quite familiar with, actually, because there was a regular Incomparable show about this not too long ago, but that is a pure coincidence, unlike the Batman Returns episode we did recently. So tell us what you've come on the show to talk about. Tell us about it. Give us some context around its release, production, its reception, why it is maligned, and why you think that that is wrong.
But Anthony, there are no coincidences, don't you know? because the film I am going to talk about, called V for Vendetta, which I feel like I just heard millions of fans just groan in derision, as happened immediately after the film's release in 2005, because it's an adaptation of the enormously beloved V for Vendetta comic by Alan Moore and David Lloyd. Like anything that is adapted for film by Alan Moore, it was quite severely maligned by Alan Moore himself, to the point where he took his name off the credits, quite famously. And his long and storied history of hating any kind of adaptation of his work is pretty well documented, I think. And certainly when it came out, all of my friends who loved V for Vendetta despised the film. And I found myself this outlier who just not only enjoyed it, with some caveats, but also thought it was a really interesting and worthy adaptation of the book, but have rarely had the opportunity to actually say why, because no one is interested in hearing why usually. So I'm really excited for this opportunity to actually put forward my arguments as to why. And mostly it comes down to, I should start by explaining my history with comics, which is that when I was a kid, when I was like, I don't know, 10, was when I started reading X-Men comics. And I was mostly reading my best friend's comics. I didn't know where to buy them. They were just something that like existed in boys' houses usually. And I loved the X-Men. I loved Generation X. But I wasn't reading with any kind of regularity or continuity. It was something that sort of tuned into the cartoons that I was watching also. And so it was like many, many years later, not that many really in the grand scheme of things. I was like 16 afterwards. A friend of mine said, "Oh, but don't you understand? Comics are so much more than superhero comics. You should read these comics by Alan Moore," and gave me V for Vendetta and Watchmen to read. And of those two, V for Vendetta was what I fell in love with. I was blown away by it. I completely adored it. I reread it and reread it loads of times. I was really excited for the film when it was announced. I was excited that it was going to be written by, or rather adapted by, the people who did The Matrix, which I also loved at the time. So the Wachowski siblings' involvement in this is notable. But I don't think had experienced a lot of books or properties being adapted for film at that point yet. So there was just so much to look forward to in it. And then when I saw it, I feel like in spite of having had relatively high expectations of enjoyment, I came away from it being satisfied that this had hit the right buttons for me, of a film that, for one thing, was very shortly after 9/11, and so was engaging with some of the conversations there, as opposed to the conversation that the comic is having. And just it worked for me. And I watched it again last night, and watched it while my husband was sort of teasing me, going, "Oh, what happens if you watch it and you realize that actually it's terrible and you can't actually go and defend it in good faith on this show?" And there was, I have to say, a brief moment where I also was afraid that this would happen, especially given our current political climate and how much I kind of needed it to be the way that I remembered it. But no, actually, it did. It shone through in the same way. The same things that annoyed me still annoy me. But having recently reread the book as well, I could appreciate better where it departed and why. And yeah, I think that's kind of what I want to mostly talk about. I was going to say, like, how much of my argument should I be putting in here, or do you want to talk about it? Because you've seen it, obviously.
Yeah, no, I've seen it. I was going to ask you if you had read the book first, because I, much like you, I actually prefer V for Vendetta to Watchmen. I love Watchmen as a work of craft, as a sort of piece of formalism of comics craft, is almost unparalleled. I mean, it's amazing.
Agreed.
But in terms of what I actually enjoy reading and what sort of inspires me in terms of its content, V for Vendetta is my favorite of Alan's early works, no question. It is, and I think the one really good thing that they did with this adaptation is, as you say, change the, which of course a lot of people didn't like, was change the political sort of sphere, if you like, because the book was so clearly a reaction to Thatcher's Britain and the looming threat of fascism and nuclear war that was around at that time. And I lived through that. You know, I'm old enough that I grew up in Thatcher's Britain. I remember that. And maybe that's why the book had such a tremendous impact on me. Maybe not. I don't know. I mean, it's impossible for me to separate that. But yeah, that's not, in 2005, that's not going to fly. You know, they couldn't do that. I mean, then they would have effectively just been remaking 1984. And what's the point in that? Yeah. So I think that was a really good thing that they did. Now, I have some issues with how they did it and the execution and things like that. But I do agree that that was, that would be pointless trying to make the movie any other way. They had to adapt it to our modern sort of political sphere, which, of course, 12 years on now actually ironically feels kind of quaint and dated.
Exactly. That's that was something that was so startling to me rewatching it. I think the thing maybe that I think the source of people maligning it as they do mostly is that it's not a great illustration of the comic. It is absolutely an adaptation, and it's an adaptation not with a view of giving you the experience of the comic, but an adaptation with a view to sort of translating the comic into a different context. One thing that that Stu and I were talking about afterwards was it would be fantastic to see this done as a BBC miniseries. Like, imagine this is a 6-part miniseries that actually managed to capture something of the grime, the downtroddenness, the Thatcheriness of everything, and so on. If that by people who actually, you know, get Britain, whereas the film is just not doing that. The film is, I mean, in every aspect of it, the film looks, and this is where I think these choices are very deliberate. The film looks sterile in so many ways, where the comic is dank and grimy. And I really feel it's a deliberate choice. There are so many changes from things that are, I mean, when you have, for instance, Prothero, the character of Prothero, who in the book is just the voice of fate. Like, the man himself is completely beside the point. It's radio. It's the voice of fate. That's what shouldn't change. That's what needs to be continuous. It's a completely personalityless voice because it's supposed to represent the computer fate, right? In the film, Prothero is a talk show host. His personality is front and center to the point where when he's killed, he's literally flanked by, you know, three mirrors or like, you know, reflecting him on all sides. He's literally watching himself on television, obsessed with his self-image and his lighting and everything else. And that's what we see of him. And in order to make, I mean, a choice that is so the opposite of the book, you have to expect that, like, I mean, they're doing this for a reason. And the reason, I think, broadly, though I think it's slightly more complicated than this, but broadly is the knowledge that they're addressing an American audience that doesn't listen to radio but does watch talk shows, you know. where you do have Rush Limbaughs and Bill O'Reillys and so on, and that they see like that is those are the people who are governing a large part of the body politic, for much worse, you know, I was going to say better or for worse, but for absolutely categorically worse. Yeah. And it's just really interesting to see that kind of change. Not all of the character deaths have that depth to them. Like the bit with Lilliman, was, I think, probably a missed opportunity. But by and large, those changes are really remarkable. And I think one of the biggest changes as well, is what, like the introduction of Stephen Fry's character. And I learned that apparently so at first I thought, oh, maybe they just had Stephen Fry and they wanted to like create a character for him and that was fine. And then realized, no, they'd written the character already and they cast Stephen Fry in it. But, so Stephen Fry plays, another, I think, talk show host basically, who does, you know, who has a sort of more, late night show, variety show kind of thing.
I think the difference is that, and we're never shown full episodes of these shows because that would take much too long, obviously. I think the difference is that Prothero, the voice of Fate, or in the movies he's called the voice of London, I think, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Is more like, he's kind of like a fascist Keith Olbermann. He's like just a guy who rants at the camera by himself for 10 minutes, it seems. Whereas, yes, Gordon, Stephen Fry's character, who is very loosely connected to a character in the graphic novel, but not in any real meaningful way. He is much more of, a sort of traditional, American style late night sort of talk, chat and variety show, which we don't really have over here. Even now, we don't really have that in England.
Yeah, exactly. It was more of a Conan O'Brien vibe, I think.
Right.
And the interesting thing about that for me was the introduction of that character. Okay, this is going to be a bit complicated and possibly a bit wanky, but it's just, there's a thing in the film which you could say is a bug, but I think is a feature, which is that the world building as they have cast it in their adaptation, the adaptation being that, you know, that there was an inciting incident for this rise of fascism, and that inciting incident was, in fact, a government conspiracy to unleash a plague on the children of Britain first, and then in the ensuing chaos, rise to power with a cure, right? And that is, I mean, it's slightly ham-fistedly, you know, supposed to parallel 9/11. I don't think there's any escape from that. There are all the conspiracy theories at the time, and probably still to this day. You know, they're the 9/11 truthers or whatever. But what you couldn't really escape from is, regardless of who perpetrated the acts, 9/11 was absolutely used to crack down on people's civil liberties. We always talk about living in a post 9/11 world. I think artists in particular, familiar with texts that talk about these sorts of things, were really driving this narrative of, in lots of stories, where government takes over in the wake of disaster to an unprecedented extent. But oh my gosh, the final act twist is that they even perpetrated the inciting incident. How can you trust your governments? They are doing evil, bad things. So that is the story that this chooses to tell. It doesn't really make any sense in the world building. Like when you watch the film and you see that, all the people who you see are living very middle class lives, very unhampered lives, aside from the curfew that starts things off, even the curfew doesn't really make sense, because you see people like at bars late at night. Whenever you have a shot looking at the people watching the television in various moments, and there's a lot of that because this is a film very, very interested in people looking at screens. And so it kind of mirrors the surveillance stuff by having people always watching the television that's supposed to be telling them the stuff that they are, it's trying to control their minds, but everyone is just kind of rejecting it, anytime we're shown people watching television, they're overwhelmingly going, oh, that's nonsense, isn't it? That's nonsense. And rejecting what's clearly lies. So you don't really get the sense that this is a downtrodden population when, I mean, the horror of the plague is supposed to be maybe 15 years old within the timeline of the film, or maybe longer than, I mean, you get that line about Finch being a party member for 27 years
right.
or something. And it's like, well, that timeline doesn't really make sense. I mean, unless he was a party...
Unless he was a party member before the incident happened.
Before the rise to power. Yeah. Which, again, is sort of... I've never really understood that. But this was true of Finch's character in the book as well. You know, seeing how he fits into the regime is a bit puzzling sometimes. Like, you know, I don't know, the one good cop in the regime who has mysteriously stuck around for that long without being black bagged or just gotten rid of himself. It's interesting. But the point is that the timeline doesn't make sense. And so the world building doesn't make a ton of sense. But what it allows for is a really interesting relationship with its past. So you get the you get Evie's history. You get Evie's moment where she's explaining to V about how connected she was to the incident at St. Mary's, how her brother died there, how her parents became political, how her parents were disappeared in the night, and she was sent to a re-education facility. You know, you get that history. And specifically, you get that vision of her hiding under the bed and then watching as her parents are like knocked to the floor and black bagged and taken away. And then that exact thing happens with Gordon, with Stephen Fry's character. And what's interesting to me about that scene is that it's the fact that Gordon doesn't think bad things can happen to him. He feels sufficiently insulated by his wealth, his position, his privilege, that... he thinks he can get away with tweaking the regime's nose when he, like, you know, does that satirical bit. He thinks he can get away with that when Evie absolutely knows he can't. And that dynamic is one that I felt was really important, and really important now, especially, that sort of repetition of history within living memory, which... admittedly, the timeline is awkward, but it allows for the fact that Evie knows bad things happen in a way that Stephen Fry somehow doesn't. I keep saying Stephen Fry because he's just so Stephen Fry. I mean,
he may as well be playing himself.
He may as well. And I mean, that was another thing about that character that I really appreciated. This is a V for Vendetta that is almost exclusively about queer rights. You know, they're just, it's, I don't know, repeated how many times over about you get the core story of Valerie and you get Stephen Fry being gay and giving that speech about being gay and not being able to bring home who he wants and things like that. And that was also like a huge part of the conversation in 2005. Like the people were still, I want to put this in the past tense, but now I can't. But, you know, people were still fighting for marriage equality. People were still fighting for all sorts of queer rights, you know, employment rights and various things. And I remember when I first saw the film, because I am, like, I'm bisexual, this really meant a lot to me. Like, this was as sort of over-the-top earnest as it was, it really resonated with me to have that statement come specifically from Stephen Fry, you know, who lived through, who also lived through Thatcher's Britain, and who, you know, all the fact that the, you know, Alan Moore's introduction to V for Vendetta mentions them, you know, they're talking of taking the word homosexual out of the dictionary and things like that. So having that illustrated was really important to me. Having that spoken was I think good, but specifically though, that parallel that, like, Stephen, he just doesn't think bad things can happen. She knows they can. He's convinced he's going to get a slap on the wrist and a fine, but he can continue to, like, fight the power in this way. She knows that horrible things are coming. Was so important just to kind of understand that, like, there are populations who have been living with this kind of fear and oppression and brutality and marginalization for a long time, who keep on trying to say, you have no idea how bad things are going to get. And then people who, you know, are very suddenly realizing how bad things can get.
Yeah.
So even though, again, like, you can quibble with the fact that, like, wait, shouldn't Stephen Fry know this? I mean,
he does display remarkable naivety. Yes, it is kind of, it is a bit, you know, on the nose. But it's absolutely, I mean, and that has a very clear, you know, modern parallel with the political situation today. I've even seen, you know, since last November, I have seen quite a few people of color, especially online, sort of, you know, pointing things out and saying, like, now you know how we've felt our entire lives.
Yeah.
And Clause 28 was the thing that Thatcher's government was most famous for in that respect. And what that's what Alan was talking about in that introduction. What that was part of a local government act in the mid-80s, where it banned the so-called promotion of homosexuality in local authority literature, in schools, which of course are run by local authorities, and not just promote the idea, but promote the acceptance of it as a legitimate relationship, as a legitimate family status. It was really, really draconian. You know, to them, of course, what constitutes promotion? Well, it was broadly interpreted to mean that basically just talking about it, that you essentially could not mention homosexuals in schools without falling foul of this law. So it really was quite horrendous. And, you know, we thought that all that was in the past, but again, recent events have shown that maybe not so much. Hello, everyone. Sorry to interrupt this wonderful discussion of V for Vendetta, but this is the time of year when we remind you about how you can support Unjustly Maligned by becoming a member of the Incomparable Network. You can do that by signing up for a monthly or annual pledge to support the show and the network directly. All you have to do is go to theincomparable.com/members. That's theincomparable.com/members and sign up. You'll then be asked to pick the shows on the network that you would like to support. And if you just check the box for Unjustly Maligned, your entire contribution will come to us, after admin fees for the network, obviously. If you do listen to other podcasts on the Incomparable Network, you can also check their boxes. And if you do that, then your contribution will be shared equally by all the shows that you want to support. But members don't just get a warm glow inside from knowing that they're helping their favourite shows keep going. No, no. They also get an exclusive members-only audio feed with extra stuff to listen to, access to an unedited so-called bootleg feed of The Incomparable. There's a members-only Slack, and other random cool stuff, such as, because this is pledge season this month, many shows on the network are posting bonus episodes created just for members. For example, I am putting together a special Unjustly Maligned episode where listeners can defend something of their choice. I'll answer questions from members, and maybe some other stuff that will be a surprise. And that episode will only be available to members. It will never go on general release. Members can pledge $5, $10, or $20 per month, and annual equivalents are also available. And if you're already a member, it's also now very easy to increase your pledge to a higher level and get even more special goodies in return. So if you'd like to support this show and the network, go to theincomparable.com/members to sign up right now. Thank you very much. Now, back to the show. I agree with you that that's a really powerful moment, the sort of recycling of history and Stephen Fry's character displaying his naivety, thinking that his, as you say, his privilege and his wealth and his fame will protect him. And I do actually like that very much in the film. However, getting to that with the government conspiracy thing in the timeline, that's the one big issue that I have with this film more than anything else. Like, as you said at the start, Alan is famously not in favor of adaptations of his work, or at least not these sorts of adaptations.
Yeah.
This is an area where he and I disagree quite a lot. Because I've done adaptations of Alan's work into comics.
Of course. Yeah. Right, it was Fashion Beast, wasn't it?
Yeah, and yeah. Well, and many others besides. Yeah, the right. difference is that, you know, those were done with very specific guidelines and instructions, which I was happy mm-hmm. to follow, mm-hmm. of following the text pretty much to the letter mm-hmm. as far as was possible. And that he's fine with. But when they... do a Blade Runner, essentially, yeah. which is how yeah. I look at this movie. I think you have to separate the book and the movie, and you look yeah. at it like Android's Dream of Electric Sheep and Blade Runner, or even a more modern example would be the Bourne Identity movie franchise, which has almost no relationship to the books, really. But they are still obviously great books and great movies. This is a great book, and I wouldn't personally say a great movie, but I think it's an okay movie. I'm not as down on it as many people. Yeah. But yeah. my one big problem with it is this, the government conspiracy, because in the book, I mean, the book in many ways is quite politically naive. You know, Alan was a young man when he wrote it. It's quite sort of naive in the way that, you know, it suggests that perhaps anarchism is the answer to all our problems. Not that I think Alan necessarily believes that, but it was clearly the point he was, yeah. the argument that he was trying to illustrate in the book. And I mean, yeah, there are some elements of it, as I say, that are quite naive. However, it is complex in the sense that it lays the blame at the feet of ordinary people.
Yes,
in
yes.
the book, the Norsefire are elected and continue to be elected. They haven't abolished elections. It's made quite mm-hmm. clear that people keep electing them because they want them in power, rather yeah. than the sort of hoodwinking government conspiracy and then remove elections and we're a one-party state now that they have in the movie, which I think is a little too... that in itself, I think, is naive. Or at least it felt so in 2005.
Right. Well, this is exactly it, right? I mean, that's... and that was something I was noticing about this as well. I appreciate so much about the book and that it gives us a dystopia that doesn't have a MacGuffin. You know, a lot of dystopias, you need a MacGuffin. You need, oh, well, everyone has drugs in the water. Oh, you know, the population's being kept docile. Oh, you know, everyone is fitted with implants that control their, you know, think of literally any dystopia in a Doctor Who episode, right? And there's some kind of MacGuffin to explain why people are behaving in the way that they are, allowing the dystopia to be, allowing authoritarianism, allowing, yeah. you know, totalitarianism. And the fact that it is just ordinary people who, you know, no one when they create a dystopia ever talk about the role of apathy, of just, you know, political disengagement and apathy, allowing for this to happen. And I loved about the book that was what happened. And ostensibly, I mean, I do think that the film, I mean, again, this was to me the post 9/11 context where I really feel like what they were specifically addressing was that willingness to allow government in the wake of disaster to strip away civil liberties and to, you know, the security theater at airports, the erosion of people's just basic rights and things in the name of national security is something that has become so accepted and banal since 2001. It's genuinely shocking to me all the time. I mean, just this morning, I learned this over the weekend and became quite upset, and I'm going to tell you a bit about Canadian politics very briefly. This morning, Parliament is reviewing a proposed bill, Bill C-23, which would allow U.S. border agents to detain Canadians on Canadian soil as they try to cross into the U.S.
Ah, yes, I saw that, yeah.
Right. So essentially, it means that if you are approaching, if you're at, you're in the so-called pre-clearance area in an airport, in, for instance, Ottawa, where I live, and you don't like the line of questioning which they're subjecting you to, which has happened to me, not in Ottawa, but in Newark, which I do not ever want to go to again, but if they start, for instance, asking you all sorts of probing, aggressive, terrible questions about your family, your religion, wanting to look into your phone, wanting your social media passwords, if they want any of those things, and you say, actually, you know what? I'm not okay with this, and I'm going to cancel my trip and leave. You won't be able to leave. They will be able to keep you there until you give a reason for why you want to leave. They're supposed to be a kind of provision for only a reasonable delay, but that's as long as they want it to be. So,
right. Who defines what's reasonable?
Exactly. And your failure to cooperate with them could result in you being arrested and having, you know, a federal charge on your record as a consequence, which if you're someone who travels to the US a lot for work, as I do, is sort of not, it's incredibly career damaging. So all of these things are happening now. And this is a bill, I have to say. I mean, this was drafted under Obama with Stephen Harper's conservatives before the current Liberal Party, but it's still being reviewed and it's still being expected to pass, even under the current regime in the US and its, like, you know, just vile awfulness. And it's just shocking to me. It's shocking to me that this is something that could just pass by like this. The first I learned of it was yesterday, and it's being reviewed today. So after this podcast, I am going to be calling quite a lot of people.
Right.
but it's stunning to me that this is something that can be happening. That we just kind of take it as the next logical step in this erosion of our rights. There are always going to be people who say, well, but, you know, I mean, why wouldn't you just go through with it? I mean, just, it looks like an admission of guilt if you are trying to, you know, back away.
That's the issue, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, exactly.
That's the problem with rolling back these, you know, sort of authoritarian increases in surveillance and, you know, lack of privacy and, as you say, sort of a very intrusive stuff at borders, and not just America, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that, again, in this post 9/11 world, it is politically really, really tricky to say, actually, we're going to relax those things. We're going to, mm-hmm. we think that that danger's past now, or at least that wasn't effective. And now we're going to allow you to keep your shoes on when you go on board a plane. We're going to allow you to take drinks, soft drinks and stuff on board a plane. We're going to allow you to, you know, come through our borders without subjecting you to half an hour of intense questioning. And it's really difficult to do that because they know that the minute something does happen, that's what will be blamed. They will be blamed for, say, well, this wouldn't have happened if you hadn't, you know, rolled back these restrictions and stuff, which is absolute rubbish. But politically, unfortunately, that's the reality that many politicians are dealing with. And it takes a politician, as a result of, you know, some significant bravery, to stand up and make those points. And mm-hmm. we appear to be lacking many politicians these days who have sufficient bravery to do that.
Yeah, exactly.
But this does tie, I mean, talking about complexity and stuff in that sense, does actually tie into another big difference between the book and the film, and something. Now, I understand, obviously, the film had to be simplified. Mm-hmm. Again, you know, having done adaptations, not just of Alan stuff, I also adapt the Alex Rider YA novels into graphic novels.
Cool.
And those do have to be cut and simplified to fit them into the space that we have for a graphic novel. There's just, because the novels are, you know, there's too much in them. You have to cut and massage and what have you. And that's just mm-hmm. a part of doing an adaptation. So the fact that the storyline in general of V Vendetta has been, you know, very significantly streamlined and slimmed down for the movie and simplified, I don't have too much of a problem with, because you've only got 2 hours, you know, and you're adapting a 300-page graphic novel. So that's
right.
and a dense graphic novel at that. So I don't have a problem with that. However, one of the things that they lost with, especially with the government conspiracy stuff, is that V in the book is a really difficult protagonist.
Like, yes.
It's tough. It's tricky to even call him a hero, frankly, mm-hmm. because he is ruthless and violent. He's pushing a very, very firm anarchist agenda. He is, you know, he does some very, very questionable, inhumane things. But it's also not just about revenge and taking down a fascist state. It's about literally turning the world into this anarchist state instead. Whereas mm-hmm. in the movie, it's kind of hard to bet against him. You know, in the movie, he's very sympathetic. He's ultimately selfless. He's portrayed as a freedom fighter pushing back against a fascist state. I mean, who in their right mind, other than actual fascists, who's not going to support that, you know?
Well, this is a really interesting thing to me as well. I find in the film the moments where V says anything like, you know, when he's talking to Evie and he says, you know, there is a face under this mask, but it's not who I am, you know, blah, blah, blah. Or the point where he's about to kill Creedy, and he says, because under this mask is an idea and ideas are bulletproof, you know, that sort of thing. I have to chortle because there is no ideology in this film. Like there is no idea under the mask.
Right. When he says that in the comic, it makes sense because he is pushing this very specific agenda. Yeah,
exactly. But in the film, the only, and now, mind you, again, this is a moment where this film benefits from being watched now. The idea ultimately in this film is anti-fascism. Like the idea is fascism is bad. And shockingly, we are in a state now where that is an idea that needs, you know, the justification, or, you know, you can't take it as read. You can't take it for granted anymore that is a kind of banal statement of yes, indeed.
That pretty much everybody agrees with, yeah.
Exactly. And so, I was really struck by this rereading the book before the film as well, where you get, there were some things that did puzzle me, admittedly. I was like, oh, they changed Susan's name to Sutler. That's interesting. What was it, confusing? But, or they changed...
That a man had a woman's name, yeah.
Yeah, a boy named Sue. But but they also changed weird things, like the roses are called Violet Carsons in the book, and they're called Scarlet Carsons in the film. And little things like that where I was like, why did you change that? I mean... presumably there were reasons, but either way, I mean, like, is this like a kind of, you know, Americans won't understand what a jumper is moment? I don't know. So there's a moment where, in the book, Susan is having a, you know, thinking to himself, and he's saying that, yes, I'm a fascist. What of it? You know, kind of thing. And it's a shockingly charming moment in the book, you know, that you kind of see the stance that the writer and I mean the creators are taking, where it's like, oh yes, you know, yes, our baddie is a fascist, this is obvious and stuff, and he also is on board with him being a fascist, you know, he still has interiority, he still has you know, his wants and desires and whatever, they're just fascist wants and desires, and it was interesting. Whereas, like in the film, you don't get that interiority from Sutler or from basically any of the other characters because of that streamlining.
Yeah, I mean, in the book, it's the old cliche that every villain is the hero of his own story.
And yeah, that's, yeah.
Because that whole chapter, and it is a very short chapter, but that whole chapter about Susan, I'd say, explaining how he can justify being a fascist is very much, okay, you know, how does this guy see it? Because clearly, you know, yeah, nobody thinks of themselves as being evil. So how do you justify it to yourself? And I don't know how much research or, you know, whether that drew on things that other that historical fascists may have said, but it comes across as quite convincing.
It does.
Not convincing in the sense that it makes me go, oh yes, what a great idea fascism is, but convincing that I could very easily believe a person would justify fascism to themselves in that way. And as you say, that's, you know, that's not there in the movie, partly, as you say, as a result of the streamlining, but also I think some of that is because they know they can rely to an extent on the way they present Sutler in the movie, especially
on the
using John Hurt.
Oh my gosh. Okay, absolutely. So this is the other thing I loved about the film, because I'm going to get back to the things I love about the film.
Yes.
I love John Hurt in it so much. The casting in general was so superb, and it blew me away when I first watched it to see the characters from the book illustrated by such utterly brilliant actors and just who looked the part so well. I mean, I could not get over Finch being cast the way he was. And brief casting note, there's not one, but two Lestrades in this film. The actor who plays Lestrade in Sherlock is here.
Rupert Graves, yeah.
Yes, and the one who plays Sherlock in the films, who's also Mr. Norrell, Eddie Marson, is in it too.
Of course, yes.
And Eddie Marson, he's actually going to be in a film of one of your comics, right? Like the Coldest City?
Eddie Marson is in The Coldest City, yes, that's
yes,
right. Yeah.
Yes, yes. So, anyways, I was just looking up his cast history, and that came up, and I was like, what? but anyway, so the casting is absolutely brilliant. I was so blown away to see, like, young Rupert Graves. It was super charming. But John Hurt, I mean, the fact that they transformed Susan into Sutler, and instead of the Susan who was very calm, very cool and collected and everything, they have... And who you do get to see in person, you instead get this enormous, literally, homage to 1984.
Yep.
And this reversal of John Hurt's character, you know, Winston Smith becomes ultimately Big Brother, you know, yep. Becomes the huge face on a screen. And that he's just perfect. He's perfect. There's a moment where he's giving an angry speech to the scary people in the room, which I also found visually very effective. Just that kind of, because in the book, all the agents, you know, the finger, the voice, the head, the whatever, or the eyes, the nose, all of those bits.
They're all in separate locations, aren't they? They're all in their own offices.
Exactly. They're all in their separate offices, and they're all kind of, you get the sense that they work against each other more than they work together. In the film, instead, to get that panel of pasty white men, you know, just kind of deciding the fate of the country was so effective. And it, especially in, you know, because of the recent photos of, like, look at this panel of pasty white men deciding about, you know, women's reproductive issues. Look at this panel of pasty white men deciding literally everything about everything, you know. Look at the context of, you know, oh, look, we had, we, not me, obviously, but the rest of the world, basically, had one black president and the world went to shit thereafter because, you know, the US just couldn't deal with that and they had to revert to full-out fascism instead. You know, it's just that kind of, everything to do with that was so well represented by that scene of just these men with only their pasty whiteness lit, like it was like they were practically glowing in the darkness around them, and this huge screen in front of them was so well done. Anyway, so John Hurt's giving this speech, and the camera is slowly zeroing in on just his mouth, and it's, my God, it was just so effective, and so well done, and he is utterly magnificent. And
he's so good, isn't he? Considering that, as you say, he's, you know, so famous for playing Winston Smith.
Exactly.
To be willing to come in and play effectively Big Brother, I thought was remarkable. But he also then does such a great job of it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And he even does a great job of playing his own impersonator as well.
Yes,
I love
right.
the fact that he's the guy who plays his own lookalike and they just cake him in makeup.
Oh, exactly. Oh, it was so beautiful. I feel the loss of him very keenly. He was so wonderful.
He really was.
He brought, I mean, that role could have been so bad. I mean, it could have been so over the top and just, but he makes it effective and scary and wonderful. And you really get, like, unlike Susan, you get the sense that, you know, he is the director of policy in a really absolute kind of way. He's also used very much in the iconography of Norsefire, you know, bringing out all of the, like, oh, in case you didn't get that they're fascist and they're, like, kind of like Nazis, look at all this. Let us show you, zero in on the jackboots, zero in on the you know, the crowds and the frothing and the ranting and the, you know, everything else.
And then the portraits of him hanging on the walls in everyone's house, you know, in a very sort of Hitler or Kim Jong-un style of, you know, every house must have a portrait of him on the wall, otherwise clearly you're a seditionist.
Exactly. So he was brilliant. And I just kept thinking that the rest of the casting was also, I mean, it did so much work, I thought, conveying the textures of the book that the film couldn't do otherwise, that like the things that got streamlined out of the screenplay, I felt that the actors were doing a really good job of bringing into the film otherwise.
I thought Stephen Ray did that very well with his portrayal of Finch. His accent, not the greatest, but his acting was absolutely spot on. And yeah, he gave, as you say, there's no time to sort of go into the complexity that we do with Finch in the book. Mm-hmm. But you can see it in Stephen Ray's face and that lovely hangdog expression and the slightly rumpled clothing and just the way he moves and the tiredness that you feel like coming off him. This is a man who is just weary and just wants to be able to get on and do his job, but instead he's got to deal with all this crap.
Exactly. It's so funny, the bit where he's talking about having visited Lark Hill and he's just going, I just had a feeling. And I just keep waiting for Rupert Graves to go, were you on drugs maybe at this moment? But no.
Well, that's the irony, of course, in the book he is.
Exactly.
He takes LSD when he goes there, doesn't he?
Well, precisely. Exactly, which they didn't put in the film. So, but the fact that they kept in the bit where he's like, I'm going and I'm going to understand everything and so on. As much as the lead up, like, so what happens in that scene, right, is he's sitting there wearily in a chair and he's describing things. And as he's describing things, you're sort of getting a supercut of moments from the film otherwise, to illustrate the things that he's saying. And at first, I'm just kind of sighing and going, oh dear, this worked much better in the book. But, you know, they couldn't actually have him go there, drop acid and, you know, understand everything, right? So instead, he goes there, comes back, and what you get is him describing how he just had a feeling. But immediately after that moment, when Dominic asks, you know, well, do you know what's going to happen? He goes, no, but I can guess. That moment on, I found very effective. At that moment on, you start getting the cuts from, you know, someone is going to do something stupid. And you see, you know, one of the fingermen shooting the little girl with the glasses, who's been playing around with a Guy Fawkes mask. And then people will react to that. And you see like this crowd kind of coming around him and stuff. And basically this idea that people are a pressure cooker right now and something's going to explode. I found that was the first moment where I actually felt that the film understood how people work. I should say it was interested in portraying how people work instead of portraying, you know, making some kind of visual statement about things. Because like the idea that, I mean, we have seen since then riots happening and protests happening in the wake of people being murdered by police, you know, in a way that, so this suddenly felt like, oh yes, this is a moment where the film kind of gets that in the way that it's not interested in representing at the very end when you get the kind of like the waves and waves of people in Guy Fawkes masks, like, you know, marching on Parliament. Was always a moment that I felt like the film just, it was no longer operating under the same protocols there. It was just about making a visual theatrical statement.
Right. It feels like a fantasy at that point. And not necessarily in a bad sense, but I mean, combined with the fact that, of course, when they all lift up their masks, some of the people under there are
dead.
Characters, you're right, that we have seen be killed.
Yes.
Or that we assume are killed, such as Gordon, Stephen Fry's character, you know, dragged off and black bagged.
Exactly.
So yeah, it does, at that point, it suddenly becomes a fantasia, which is,
yes.
Yeah, visually it looks great and it's sort of, you know, it makes its point, but it does lose that sense of naturalism that up until then the film's been pretty good about keeping.
Exactly. And that was the thing, like there is, I think, a difference between saying, oh, the film just, you know, it just doesn't get it versus it's just choosing to do a different thing in this moment. Because that marching is happening at the same time that that Evie is talking about how, you know, V is you, V is me, V is everyone kind of thing. So that's when you see, it is like definitely dead people happen. Like there's a moment where So I was watching this with my husband Stu, and he was like, "What? We just saw a black person. What?" And I was like, "Well, yeah, because they're showing the dead people from like Lark Hill
from
and stuff.
From the camps and stuff, yeah.
From the camps." And he was like, "What? No, they're not." And he hadn't noticed before that this was what they're doing. And I was like, "Yeah, no, look. And went through and show. They show the little girl who just got shot. They show Valerie and her lover. They show Stephen Fry, you know. So they are, and that felt very recognizable to me from theater. It felt like a curtain call, you know. Everyone dead comes back and says goodnight, basically, and heads off. And it did, so it was more interested in making a visual statement, similarly to what's happening in the film at that point, is that they're blowing up Parliament as a statement. And here the film is making this statement. It's very over the top statement, about how, you know, we all need to fight fascism, basically.
Right. Which, as you say, you know, you'd think wouldn't be a controversial stance, but,
exactly. And honestly, I think the film, as much as there is a lot of naivete in it, there is a lot of stuff that that I absolutely think. One thing I wish the film did more was trust its audience more. There are moments where you just kind of, as much as I love this film, I go, "Oh, did you have to do that?" Like the moment where Evie is. The moment where Evie is on the roof in the rain, and they keep cutting from her in the rain to like
to V in the fire,
the fire, and they don't do it just once; they do it over and over. And it's like, look, we understand. There's water and there's fire.
And we only saw that flashback like 10 or 15 minutes ago.
Exactly, and we're gonna see it again. See it like towards the end as well. So it's just like they really loved seeing that silhouette backlit in flame, you know. It was like, "Oh, look, this is one part where we absolutely are doing what the comic did. Look, let me show it to you again and again." So I do wish they trusted the audience more. I wish they spelled things out a little less, but I think that they're also just operating in a different conversation and a different lineage, I think, of like political science fiction films. Usually, you know, big Hollywood SF films and stuff aren't subtle. they aren't subtle, and they and people don't expect them to be subtle. People want bromides in these films, and so you get those statements about, you know. God, I have many feelings about Rogue One, but like one of the things was hope. Rebellions are built on hope. It's like, really? I mean, does that statement actually stand up to scrutiny? I'm not sure. I'm not sure if rebellions are actually built on hope. I'm pretty sure they're built on like misery and anger and fury and rage. I'm not sure that hope actually figures in there a lot, but it's part of a grand American narrative. So I can recognize, I recognize when it's operating that way, basically.
Well, I think the other ballpark that they're playing in with this is the modern superhero aesthetic, the modern movie superhero aesthetic, which, absolutely, of course, the book presents a kind of superhero in V, but in a very, very unconventional and non-traditionally superhero way. You know, the mm-hmm. David Lloyd's artwork does not look like a regular superhero book. The things he does are not things that a regular superhero does, and, you know, his philosophy, etc. Whereas the film uses the visual trappings mm-hmm. of a modern superhero movie, complete with his outfit, the slow-mo gory violence, the knife trails as they fly through the air, things like ridiculous things like that, which frankly I could have done without, but I know that a modern audience expects that from a superhero mm-hmm. movie. They use those trappings to prevent unconventional ideas, mm-hmm. you know, things that we aren't used to seeing, as you say, in not just modern political movies, but frankly in modern superhero movies, this idea that he might be a bit ambiguous. And while, as I said before, it's very difficult to sort of root against V in the movie because he's just an anti-fascist, at the mm-hmm. same time, he is ruthless, and he does, you know, sort of have some questionable methods, which are unconventional in modern superhero fiction on the silver screen.
Absolutely. And it's interesting that when he's introduced, you know how that whenever there's a superhero film, there's the golden rule of like a superhero must never kill, right? That like the killing is, you can brutalize someone, you can literally break every bone in their body by shoving them down some stairs, but so long as they're not dead, you're morally okay somehow. So V is introduced in the film without killing anyone. You know, the choreography of that fight with the Finger Man early on is very deliberately done to show that he's not killing them. The knives are not coming out at that point to draw blood. You know, there's some humorous things with like there's trousers falling around people's legs or whatever. But that's where it stops. Later, we see him kill people, and he has that conversation with Evie where she says, well, did you kill him? Are you going to kill more people? And he says, yes, I am. And I appreciated that. And that to me felt like a nod to Moore and Lloyd's very deliberate, because like I was reading the article that Alan Moore wrote in, what was it, like 1983, I think, which is in the back of the edition that I have, where he's talking about like more or less the creative partnership with Lloyd and how they both decided they very much did not want V to look like a superhero, and they wanted to get rid of typical superhero trappings. So there are no thought balloons. There are no sound effects, and so on. His visual style, they wanted to look weird. They wanted it to be weird and atypical. And that there are initial like attempts of his costume and stuff that do look a lot more superheroic, which they passed over and stuff. The film embracing him having the knives and stuff was funny. I mean, because you kind of have to ask. So first of all, I love knives. Like I slightly collect them a little bit. I love throwing them. Not in a general way. Not at people. At targets. I just really like the very satisfying thunk it makes when you successfully throw a knife or an axe. It's bladed weapons have been something I've been in love with since I was a teenager. I took up fencing. I just love knives and swords and things. So I was, when I first saw the film, I was delighted by the knives. I was really excited by them getting the same sort of treatment that, you know, bullets get in the Matrix and stuff like that. One of my hugest disappointments with Blade Runner is that there are no blades in it. There's like literally you Blade Runner, you think that there's going to be a knife in there at some point. There never is. It's very frustrating. So in this case, like I was okay. Admittedly, like it has not aged well, the kind of spinny knife thing, but when I saw it in theaters, I thought it looked really cool. I really liked it. I will acknowledge that that just might be my bias towards shiny knife things.
Well, and you know, as you say, the costume does look a bit more superhero-y in the movie. But like I say, I think that's, I mean, I'm not a big fan of it, but at the same time, I totally understand why they did it, because it is the modern superhero aesthetic, you know, much like how the costumes changed in Watchmen. You know, again, I don't particularly like it, but I know that that's what a modern movie audience expects from superhero costumes. You know, and there are millions and millions more of them than there are people who actually read the comics. So I totally understand why a filmmaker would cater to that audience rather than the, you know, relatively small actual comic fan audience instead.
Yes, exactly. And I think the last thing I really want to bring up as something that I deeply loved without any qualification whatsoever about the film was Valerie's letter and the way that they presented that.
I was just going to bring that up to close us out with, because that is almost shot for shot, almost exactly what's in the comic. I mean, there's a few extra things where they add, like, you know, sort of faux waterboarding scenes and stuff, but it is almost entirely just a straight retelling from the comic.
Exactly. And it was so beautifully done. It also felt so the film passes the Bechdel test technically The Bechdel-Wallace test, I mean, and it is about technicalities, but it passes it, you know, in the first act when Evie is talking to her superior who wants her to get coffee, you know? So there are two women, whatever. I don't know if that character has a name or not. No, I think she does. But to me, the moment where it passed that test was where Evie is reading this letter, where you just genuinely felt like there was something like a conversation happening between two women, where it was a woman talking about loving women to a woman without knowing it, you know, and saying that I don't know who you are. I will never laugh with you or talk with you and so on. And that's like exactly from the comic. And this may not sound like I'm giving the film a compliment, but when that happens in the book, it's part of so many different threads and strands that it doesn't stand out in the same way that it stands out in the film. When you have a film that is so much more streamlined, suddenly the letter becomes its beating heart. And I cry every time I see it. Like every time watching Natasha, is it Whiteman or Whitman? I'm not sure. Her performance is so wonderful. Her reading is so wonderful of that letter. The way that suddenly the everything is sort of suffused in this warm, slightly almost sepia light, you know, you get the sense that everything smells of roses. It's so beautiful, and actually the thing that really struck me this time around, which it didn't before, is that the timeline there is our timeline. All of a sudden, it goes from, you know, 2010, 2012, 2015. So that gave those scenes an urgency and a desperation that I hadn't experienced the first time around, where I was just stunned. I had completely forgotten this, that they kind of come into the point where we're at. So to see that, and to see the brutality intruding on that, the door is kicked down, the groceries left in the street as Valerie's lover is dragged away before they finally come and take her away. Like all of that all of the talk about like the one inch that you keep, like it was just so moving. Like I get choked up just talking about it. It was so beautifully done and so moving.
Well, I think it's really well done in the book as well. I mean, yeah. I do disagree slightly that it's not as affecting in the book, because I think that is it's what closes out the end of book two, what is now known mm-hmm. as book two in the collection, which mm-hmm. was the end of the run in when it was serialized in Warrior.
Oh,
before, because okay. Basically Alan did the first two books in Warrior, then Warrior folded and Alan had started working for DC in the States a lot more, doing things like Swamp Thing. And I think actually Watchmen as well. I think he'd done, or at least he'd started. And so they, basically DC said, well, why don't we'll pay you to do book three mm-hmm. of V for Vendetta, and then we'll and we'll take the rights to it and package it all up in a book and what have you. But mm-hmm. so, and book two ends with the Valerie story. Mm-hmm. And so it is, I mean, it's kind of a centerpiece just physically in terms of the story, but also right. certainly to me when I read it, that more than any other part of the book is the part that stayed with me and had an emotional effect on me. Like mm-hmm. the rest of it is kind of interesting from a sort of, you know, sixth form political science point of view. Or sort of deconstructing a superhero point of view. But that was the section of the story. Because everything else stops. That's the other thing, is you don't get any other part of the story intruding upon that in the book or in the movie as well. Like that, everything stops. Now we get Valerie's story from start to end. And it was so affecting, so emotionally affecting that, it was the one part of the book that really stayed with me emotionally right the way, you know, even after putting it down, long after putting it down.
See, the thing, I don't mean to diminish it in the book at all. I just mean that genuinely the book has... There are so many parts of the book that are really memorable to me, which is why I don't want it to be like a backhanded compliment to the film, in as much as there's less that's memorable in the film, so it really stands out there. But my experience of reading it all collected in the trade made it so that it was... you're absolutely right. Like the rest of everything else stops, so you don't get the sort of interweaving threads of all the other characters' psychologies and actions and interests and things. but it occupied for me a smaller part of the book. It was hugely moving in the book as well. And I loved it. I mean, it was a big part of why I loved the book. But in the film, maybe it was just the fact of having someone read it. So to have that difference as well, like having someone's voice coloring everything, it just moved me so much. I think it works the way it does in the book and in the film is because it's a bit of naturalism in an otherwise very, very speculative environment.
Right. It doesn't actually feel much like sci-fi.
Exactly. And it's, in some ways, it should be the most ordinary story. You know, it should be an ordinary story of someone's life. It should be, and instead, you know, it's tragic. And so it's that intrusion of a completely different literary genre of tragedy, you know, into this book that is so many other things. But it's also just, it's the first moment, it's not the first moment, but it's a very remarkable moment where you get how this world, this kind of the world, which up until this point has seemed like scaffolding for its main character, you know, for a place in which this character operates, a context, a fascist context that you need to resist, you know, all of those big structural elements. Suddenly you see how they affect a normal person, like a person who doesn't, who isn't fighting the state, who isn't being sucked into all of this activity like Evie is. You know, Evie ostensibly is also a normal person, but she's made different by her proximity to V. And you get this reversal instead where this ordinary woman is sort of the one who makes V who he is. So it feels... it's almost... I want to bring Doctor Who dynamics into it necessarily, but, you know, there is a way in which, you know, Evie is sort of V's companion in that sense. But Valerie is the one who makes him who he is, or makes him fight the way that he does, and kind of gives him this core to hold on to. And it's done in a way that it's not a fridging, you know, it's not her death that's affected him. It's her life. It's her, and it's, they don't know each other. It's just her cri de cœur, you know, it's her moment when she says that, you know, I have no idea who you are, but I love you. And you know, you have to hold on in this way and stuff, because it's like a letter that she could be writing to herself. So she's this character who just shines through. And the fact that the movie did that super well, is very dear to me too.
It's one of the biggest redeeming features of the movie, I think. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That they handled that scene so well, because it could have been, you can imagine 100 ways that could have been terrible, you know?
Oh, yes.
It wasn't. It was really, really great, and is, yeah, you know, much like the book, for the, I think, yeah, the most emotionally affecting sequence in the whole movie. So, yeah, you know, they really do deserve credit for that.
Exactly. The one huge bugbear that I have with the film, which maybe I shouldn't talk about because, I mean, I am defending it, but it sort of falls into the category a little bit of why I give the film as much slack as I do, which is just that in some ways it feels like fanfic of V for Vendetta. And by this, I mean specifically like the romance aspect between Evie and V, which I hate. I hate it so much. I really like, it was the one thing that made me, it just disgusted me, and it felt so unnecessary and so tacked on, because if V is a kind of weird, removed, kind of almost mythic, not person, the way that he is in the book, then you kind of, all of the torture that he puts Evie through, it sort of fits into a different category than if this is supposed to be some kind of messed up romance where he literally says, I fell in love with you, Evie. What? When you were waterboarding her? When you were like, you know, like that's just, it sits so ill with me. Like, so it's so awful. If when it's kind of coupled to the idea of romance, whenever she wants to like kiss the mask or whatever, it's so bad. But that aside is like that is the thing that I just kind of cannot forgive the film, but Valerie kind of manages to kind of erase that from that. Yeah. So yeah.
Overrides it.
Exactly.
All right. I think that's a good place to bring it to a close then. So Amal, thank you very much for coming on and talking to us about this.
It's been my pleasure.
Where can people find you if they like what you have to say about anarchist freedom fighters?
So I have a website, which is amalelmohtar.com. That's AmalElMohtar.com. And I'm also on Twitter at Tithenai, which is Tithenai. It's the Greek word from which you derive the word thesis.
Is that where it comes from? I've always
wondered
where
it comes from. Yeah, it means.
I always wondered where that was your handle.
Exactly. It means to take a stand. And I picked it. I mean, you have to understand, it was 2004. I was on LiveJournal. I had just started being a teaching assistant for someone who was teaching an 1100 course in English, like an essay writing course. And one of the ways in which he explained to students how to write essays was to say, so the word thesis comes from the Greek word tithenai, to take a stand. And the word topic comes from the Greek topos, which means an area. So when you're writing an essay, you have to take a stand within an area. And I was like, take a stand. Yes, this is appealing to me.
This is deep.
This is important. So it became my LiveJournal handle back in ye olde 2004. And then I just like, it just became my name on the internet. So I have kept it for lo these many years. I also, I'm on another podcast called Down and Safe with Scott Lynch, Liz Miles, and Michael Damian Thomas. And we talk about Blake 7, which I have not seen before. So every episode is new to me. And it's great fun.
What can people look forward to seeing from you? Because you are a writer as well.
Yes, I've got a story coming out in an anthology I'm really, really excited about called The Djinn Falls in Love and Other Stories. That's coming out March 14th, I think, from Solaris Press. And it's such a star-studded anthology. I mean, you've got like Camila Shamsi, Claire North, Neil Gaiman, a bunch of other amazing people.
Oh, wow. Some really good company then.
Yeah, I'm really blown away to be in it.
Thanks for listening to Unjustly Maligned. You can check out my other work, including comics, books, music, and more, at anthonyjohnston.com, where you'll find more information about all of my work. You can support Unjustly Maligned by becoming a member of the Incomparable Network. Go to theincomparable.com/members to sign up, and check the box for Unjustly Maligned when you choose which shows to support. You can also help by reviewing Unjustly Maligned on iTunes and following us on Twitter at UMPFM. And finally, the show notes for this episode are at ump.fm. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
There's a bunch of other stuff that's coming out like way later and things, but sure, I just co-wrote a novella with Max Gladstone, which I'm super excited about. It's still in the it won't be out for a while yet, but when it is, it's pretty great, I think.
I just finished a novel myself. I spent the last 6 months, or not last 6 months, but the last 6 months of last year writing my next novel, and that's currently with my agent at the moment. So yes,
excellent.
I know that feeling.
Yes. It's a weird thing with long form stuff. I mean, I started writing short fiction and you get like the instant gratification of, oh yes, I've written it, I've sold it, there we go, it's appearing. And with anything longer than that, suddenly it's like, what? I wrote it, now I have to wait 2 years before people
right.
can read it.
Yeah. Yeah.
No.
Blade Runner, I don't know whether you know, but the title is actually taken from a completely different story, and that's why there are no blades in it.
Yeah, someone did. tell me this after the fact.
The title is actually taken from a story about renegade doctors, renegade surgeons, hence Blade Runner.
Oh, I see.
As in a scalpel, you see.
Scalpels are not as cool as swords.
Well, no, true. It was.
I mean, they serve a very important function.
I should know this off by heart. I just can't remember whether it was a famous author who who wrote a short. I think it was a short story, not a novel, called Blade Runner. That they decided to take it. Oh, it was Burroughs, right?
Oh, right.
Yeah. Oh, there you go. Right. Yeah. So quite famous then. To a British viewer in this movie, there are quite a few things that are just like, we don't have that in England.
Yes.
And I was wondering how much of that stood out to you, or whether, as somebody who didn't grow up here, you weren't aware of them.
Oh, it absolutely... So it stood out to me a lot more this time than in my initial viewing.
Right.
In my initial viewing, I mean, the first time I went to the UK was in 2001, the summer before 9/11, in fact.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I spent a month there. It was my 16th birthday gift was to go and have a trip overseas and stay with friends of my family in Croydon. So I got to travel around a bit and see the country and stuff. And I loved it. But I went and lived in the UK from 2008 to just about 2015. And I was there for school initially, and then met my husband.
Yes.
So I ran away to Scotland and lived with him for a while. And then now he's here. He's here with me in Canada. He is I've landed him like a fish. It's a landed immigrant. So now obviously, like after having lived in the UK, it's painful in some ways how un-British it is. Like you can see very, like, even in that first instance where you see like V saving Evie from the Fingermen, it does really just look like a soundstage, you know. It's very featureless. It doesn't look anything like London. And it's also, I think, the only part where you see them almost trying to get the aesthetic of the comic, which they then totally abandon in terms of, like, everything is bright and sterile thereafter,
which
I think is supposed to kind of play into the whole medical conspiracy side of things. But
possibly, yeah.
I think that's what they're doing.
But as I said earlier, things like, you know, we don't have those late night variety talk show things over here, which obviously you'll know having lived here for a while.
Yes.
But also things like the breakfast that he makes.
Oh my god,
eggy in the basket.
It's so made up.
Why? There's no need for that at all.
Do you know what? I have to wonder if it was some really idiosyncratic, you know, one family, maybe a friend of the Wachowski says, oh yeah, we used to do this thing in my family, we called it Eggy in the Basket, which has no cultural penetration whatsoever. But it's so pointless and it's repeated. So you have to think that maybe on some level they thought that they were doing something authentic.
Right, but surely, I mean, you know, how difficult would it have been? Because I remember reading a piece with, I think it was Stephen Fry, actually, where he mentioned that, and he was like, and he said, like, it's ridiculous. I have no idea where they got it from. And he told them, you know, this isn't a thing, but they were like, well, just do it anyway.
Oh my God. Oh, that's so sad. I mean, they could have just had it be a fry up, you know, a fry up is a time honored, you know,
very authentic. It's not like fried breakfast isn't something we do, but we don't call it eggy in the basket.
Oh, it's so true. This is slightly embarrassing. That was like, it had never occurred to me before to like put a hole in some bread and crack an egg into it. And I was delighted by this when I first saw it. And it wasn't because it seemed like a British thing. I was just like, it just looks so cute.
Just sounds like a good idea.
It just seems like a good idea. You know, it just, why not? And I started making it after that. I was like, oh yeah, I'm just going to do the thing.
Really?
I did. I perpetuated it. And I have to say, I like in my head, I call it Eggy in the Basket, which is like, I know. I have always known. There was never a moment where I did not know that this is not a thing. But you know, sometimes you want to make breakfast that is toast and bread, but you don't want to toast the bread separate, toast and an egg, and you don't want to toast the bread separately, and it just kind of comes together and it's nice, and you can just So anyway,
the other thing which I wouldn't expect you or most people actually to be fair to get was the mention of in Valerie's story, the mention of she says like I took my passed my 11 plus and went to an all girls grammar school. That's like those ended in like the late 70s. There were no 11 pluses in the 80s or 90s, and certainly no all grammar schools, let alone girls only grammar schools. That ended in the late 70s or early 80s, I think. So, which of course in the graphic novel, that's fine because it's set in 1997 or something, and she's supposed to have been an adult, so you know the timeline makes sense. But in the movie, which is set in what is it, like 2025 or something like that, it's just no, that's not a thing.
The way that the word Nazi and the word fascism have been sort of hollowed out of all meaning over the course of my lifetime, such that people can't recognize it when it's happening anymore, I don't entirely blame it only on those things, but I do feel like they play a part where when you have a solid 20 years worth of the purest evil, the most unexamined, you know, most indefensible evil always is Nazis. And you see the kind of shift from it actually referring to something very specific in history to whenever you conveniently need a baddie, you know.
A bogeyman, yeah.
Exactly. And then, like, I remember the point where it just sort of shocked me how far things had gone was where when Obama wanted to bring in, the Affordable Care Act, and people were calling him a Nazi for wanting to give people, you know, comprehensive health care. It was astonishing. I was like, wait, what? But how? Is it just that people no longer know what Nazis are, and now anything that they find objectionable, they can call a Nazi? Like
anything that they perceive as the state forcing them to do something?
Yeah, I could not comprehend it. It was like, and it was terrifying because at roughly the same time, you were getting like actual fascist governments being elected in various places in Europe, and that sort of rise of things was chilling. And now we have the situation that we have, which is also chilling. Oh man, where was I going with this? It was just, right. So no, where was I going with this?